Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, when it comes to music, the late, great Duke Ellington may have said it best. There are two kinds of music, he said. Good music and the other kind. Well, today on Triad Arts Weekend, you don't have to worry about the latter because we've got a doozy of a concert for you today, and it's all good, from blues to ballads, Bach, and beyond. It's all part of 17 Days Festival with music, art, theater, and more coming to Greensboro September 20th through October 6th. And this year, they're bringing in more than 130 arts events, including a concert by multi-platinum-selling recording artist Joan Osborne. And yes, Joan Osborne is here today on Triad Arts Weekend, as is singer-songwriter extraordinaire Aoife O'Donovan, fresh off the road with cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And speaking of cellists, how about world-renowned multiple Grammy winner Matt Heimovitz? He's got an amazing cello tribute to Jimi Hendrix coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend after this news. This is Triad Arts Weekend. Since its founding in 1962, Greensboro's Arts Council has contributed approximately $20 million to area arts organizations and projects. Today, the Arts Council of Greensboro has a new name, Arts Greensboro, a new website, artsgreensboro.org, and they're continuing to contribute much more than just grants alone to the Triad community. After many months of preparation, Arts Greensboro is all set for its 17 Days Festival. This year's festival runs from September 20th to October 6th with more than 130 arts events planned, beginning with a performance Friday night, September 20th, in Dana Auditorium by multi-platinum-selling recording artist and seven-time Grammy nominee Joan Osborne.
Do you need a girl beside you to supply the love you need? I'll give you satisfaction.
Joan Osborne is considered one of the great voices of her generation. Her debut album, Relish, wove together strands of American roots music, poetic lyrics, and impassioned vocals, and produced an international hit, What If God Was One of Us? Since then, Joan has released several albums and toured extensively with her own band. As a member of the Grateful Dead, Joan appeared in the Grammy Award-winning documentary Standing in the Shadows of Motown, sharing the stage with Bob Dylan, Stevie Wonder, Emmylou Harris, and Patti Smith, just to name a few. Joan's most recent album, Bring It On Home, was nominated for Best Blues Album at the 2013 Grammy Awards, and it is good. She'll be kicking off 17 Days Festival in style beginning at 8 o'clock. Joan spoke with me by phone from her home in New York.
Stand by your side. Whoa, I'm qualified.
Gonna dive right in with Bring It On Home. You mentioned I knew when the time was right and my voice was ready. I love the richness of your voice on this album, throughout the album. Wondering what you mean by my voice was ready on that.
I had started out, you know, my singing career singing blues in, you know, bars and clubs in New York City, and that was the music that really just galvanized me, and I fell in love with it. But the singers that I admired, people like Muddy Waters and Otis Redding and Etta James and Howlin' Wolf, they had this incredible rich texture to their voices. And, you know, at that time, I certainly tried to emulate them and really wanted to have that in my voice and did the best that I could. But, you know, I was just a beginning singer, so I didn't have the kind of texture and the kind of sound that I would have loved to have had. But now, you know, fast forward 20-plus years that I've been doing this and singing, you know, almost every day, and, you know, you develop your voice by doing that and by using it. So I just feel like that combined with just being a, you know, an older person and you have a richer experience to draw from, I just feel like it's something that I feel like I was ready to make a record of this music.
Could you give me an example of something that you're able to do today, something that's continuing to develop in your singing that just comes to mind, maybe a lick, a sound, a texture that you're, hey, I don't know, I had that in me, and here it is, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much the licks and the elasticity and that sort of thing. I mean, those things you can have when you're young, and you can certainly have great technique. It's really just the richness and the texture and the sound of my voice as an instrument has changed over the years, as they will, you know. I mean, I guess you look at great opera singers and they're not considered to be at their peak until they've been doing it for decades. So I think there's just a richness of tone of the instrument itself that you get just from using it and for so long.
Yeah.
Think about good times we once had. God happy, my heart got glad.
You co-produced this most recent album, Bring It On Home. Wondering what part of the production process did you enjoy most, and what you learned through a project like this?
I just find that there are instinctive things that I'm looking to hear, and what you're trying to do is, as a producer or a co-producer rather, is help to guide the musicians and the engineers and everyone who's working with you to, you know, to get to that place. And because I'm not a trained instrumentalist, I could never tell somebody, oh, I want you to play this or play that. And I think in a lot of ways it's really unnecessary, because that's, you know, that's what the musicians do and that's what they know how to do. So if you can give them broader concepts or talk to them, you know, in images or ideas, or say, I want it to sound like, you know, you've just rolled out of bed and your hair's all mussy, and, you know, if you can speak to them in those ways, then they're usually able to take that and translate it into a musical expression. And so, I mean, I feel like as a co-producer, that's something that I can do fairly well, that I've learned to do fairly well. I've produced a couple of records for my good friends, the Holmes Brothers, and have certainly learned through trial and error that it's best to allow people to use their creativity, and instead of telling them what to do, you ask them what you're looking for, and then they're able to use their own way to get to that place.
Well, it certainly comes across as just as this just a wonderful spontaneity and energy with this one recording after the next on this album that I love. Shake Your Hips was one right off the bat that grabbed me. I was looking at the peak performance that you all did in the studio. Here you are in a, you're in a dry studio with the headphones on, but you look like you're in a trance. And I'm just wondering, how do you, I mean, it's just a great performance in such a small confine. How do you get there? What are you thinking to either put you in that mindset, or it just comes across so comfy and sincere?
Yeah. Well, part of the reason is that I was really, really fortunate to be able to bring my road band into the studio with me. And these guys are incredible players as individuals, but they have a particular chemistry when you get them together that's just really wonderful, and they've honed that over playing with me, you know, for years now. So it's, you know, it's like putting on an old sweater or something. You do feel really comfortable, and you can relax, and you can just get into the flow of the music instead of having that sort of editor voice in your head saying, oh, is this person, you know, are they with us, or is this groove happening, or is this sound the sound that I was looking to get? You don't have to think about any of that. If you have people that you've played with and worked with for years and years, you just know that you're going to get what you need. And there's something about playing songs many, many times through where, you know, they start to develop and the musicians start to feel their way into them in a way where they're very comfortable. So I was really fortunate to be able to get these guys and have them in the studio with me.
And gotta move your lips. Just shake your hips. Do the hip shake, baby. Do the hip shake, baby. Shake your hips, baby. Shake your hips, baby. Well, if you don't know, don't you be no afraid.
Yeah, avoiding the temptation to do take after take, it always amazed me reading the background for, say, a Blue Note recording in the Van Gelder studio, and they would just run it through once or twice, and they had their take. I'm reading that you actually had a pretty similar, at least that arrangement came about pretty organically. Was that true for the whole album?
Well, for that song in particular, it did. That actually was not even on our list of things to do, and it just kind of, we were in the rehearsal room working on something else, and somebody just started playing the lick for that song, and everybody knew it, and we all just jumped in and started running through it, and it really sort of took off like, you know, like wild horses. So when it was done, we looked at each other and we're like, oh, we really should put this on the record. You know?
No-brainer.
So, yeah, so that was a no-brainer.
Well, I met a little girl in a country town. She said, what do you know? Yeah, Slim Hoppo.
But, yeah, I mean, I think when you talk about those older recordings of Blue Note, or, you know, when you talk about that era, there was no conception of you go into a studio and you spend 6 months in the studio to make a record. It was, you know, the music was learned before you walked in the studio door, and you knew what you were going to do before you walked in the door. So in a way, we're sort of circling back to that, because recording budgets have gotten so low now. I mean, the music industry is really in a different place. You don't get these huge recording budgets like you would maybe 10 or 20 years ago. You have to be really frugal. So you have to know exactly what you're trying to do when you step into that studio door. And, you know, you have a blueprint and you know what you want to do. You can still be spontaneous within that, but you have to really use your time efficiently and know exactly what you want. So you spend a lot of time in the rehearsal room working things out. And I think that's very, very much, you know, in the spirit of what they used to do with those great jazz recordings. They knew what they wanted to do in there. And, of course, there was improvisation, but they had that framework worked out already.
The framework, the blueprint for this album is just a collection of great blues classics, one of which is Bring It On Home. Your take on this, the Sonny Boy Williams classic, and it's written by Willie Dixon initially. Man, you slayed me with this one. I love your version of this tune. I lived in Chicago for 15 years, spent a lot of my waiter's tips on blues clubs and down at Kingston's Mine and the Checkerboard Lounge and Biddy Mulligan's and all over. But I think I heard Coco Taylor sing this one at least once or twice. But you really make it your own. Talk about this piece and your take on it, because it's really, we're flipping genders here.
You know, thank you for the compliment. I feel like my job in this recording was, you know, as a singer, to find a way to do these songs in ways that hadn't already been done. You know, I didn't want to just copy the original versions. I didn't want to just, you know, do like you walk into a bar and see a bar band do it. I wanted to bring something unique to it, but I also wanted to be respectful of the song. So it was kind of walking a tightrope. And with that one in particular, it's not a very structured piece. It's not like a Tin Pan Alley song where you've got verses and choruses and bridges and middle eights and all that sort of thing. It's much more of a hypnotic, trance-like thing. So we wanted to just emphasize that trance-like aspect of it. And I think certainly the original version does that too, but we wanted to sort of get into it in a little bit of a different way. You know, we're working in a modern studio, so we can bring different atmospheres to a recording than they had the capacity to do back then. And that was kind of where we wanted to take it, myself and my co-producer, Jack Petrozelli, who is, you know, he's a wonderful co-conspirator in this and also a longtime friend.
You refer to these songs as a collection, as an aggregate, as a remedy. And I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit. How so?
Well, when I was using that word remedy, I was talking about what blues music meant to me when I first encountered it when I was younger. I'd been studying filmmaking at New York University, and I was fully intent on becoming a filmmaker and probably a documentary filmmaker. And, you know, that world still holds a lot of appeal for me, and it's still interesting to me. But there's something about that art form which is more of a head art form. And music is very much it involves your intellect as well, but it's very much of a soul art form, and there's a physicality to it. And I think there was something about the blues in particular that really kind of awakened that in me at that time. I think I was kind of stuck in my head and in my intellect, and this was a gateway for me to really connect with parts of myself that I hadn't been connecting with and that I really needed to connect with. So in that way, it was very much a remedy and kind of a salvation for me.
How has being a mom informed your art?
How does being a mom inform my art? Well, funny you should ask that. My daughter just came up to me. Hi, sweetie. it's interesting because on the one hand, it's almost like the complete counterintuitive thing for an artist to do, because as a parent, you really are focusing your energies and on outside of yourself, on your child and what they need, and you spend a lot of your time and a lot of your effort just, you know, raising them and doing what you need to do for them. And as an artist, you sort of have to do the opposite of that, and your focus needs to be on yourself and your craft and your work. So in a way, it's kind of like it's kind of pulling you away from what you need to do as an artist. But at the same time, you know, the thing that really surprised me about it personally was that I sort of felt like as a singer and as a musician or an artist or whatever, like I had access, you know, ready access to my emotions, and I thought that's what I believed about myself. But the experience of having my daughter, it was like it opened up this whole other emotional terrain that I didn't know was available for me, and I didn't know that I had. So it deepened me as a person, and I think that can only deepen you as an artist and really sort of in the, you know, in a macro way of allowing you to see why it's so important to, you know, to have art in your life and to be able to express yourself and to be able to connect with with music in that way. I think that's what it did for me.
I was sitting in a hot car.
What are the pluses and minuses of working multiple projects at the same time? And it seems kind of overwhelming to me. And then being a mom on top of that and being on the road. It seems like you got a lot on your plate.
Yeah, I can't lie. I do get overwhelmed, you know, on a regular basis. It's like, oh, my God, the roof needs to be fixed and the boiler doesn't work. And I'm, you know, in Chicago playing a gig and I, you know, and there's all these things that I'm supposed to be writing on. And, yeah, it's a lot. I find that, at least creatively, having more than one project going on at the same time is good because the one tends to energize and inform the other. Like it's fun for me to go from Nashville, where I'm working, you know, with the guys in Trigger Hippie and doing this like rock and roll kind of balls to the wall thing, and then go to working on this new music of, you know, my own that I'm co-writing with people for the Love and Hate project, which is, you know, there's a lot of strings on it, and it's a much different kind of thing musically. And then to go and play a concert where I'm playing a lot of the blues songs from this new record, it just keeps me from getting bored, and it keeps me, I think, excited about each project to be able to jump from one to the other. So in that sense, it's a real positive thing.
Well, you're certainly no stranger to North Carolina with, I guess, the Siren Festival in Boone, and then with Michelle.
Yeah, we were just in Boone. Mm-hmm.
That was cool. I got a chance to chat with Michelle and Dagio Cello for that gig, which was fun, and Appalachian Summer Festival as well. What can we expect here in the Piedmont Triad for your concert coming up in Greensboro?
This is one of the duo shows that I've been doing with myself and Keith Cotton, who's the keyboard player in my band and just an amazing, incredible musician. And we had been asked a while back to do a radio station fundraiser, and they wanted just a piano and vocal. So we did that, and it was very interesting for me in particular to be able to take these songs that I had been used to doing with a full band and, you know, with Keith's new arrangements, to break them down into these very bare-bones versions of the songs. And it's kind of a challenge because you're like, well, I don't have all these great arrangements that I had on the record. Is this song still, you know, does it still have an impact in that way? And it's challenging as a singer because there's certainly nowhere to hide. But we found that the audiences have just been so receptive to this, and, you know, not only to hearing songs from the records in this very stripped down version, but also the blues songs, and also we've been testing out this new material from Love and Hate on people. So it's a really it's kind of a unique concert experience for anybody who's ever seen us before. This is kind of a different thing, and it's very intimate and fun. We've just been having a great time with it.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's ailing me.
Multi-platinum selling recording artist and 7-time Grammy nominee Joan Osborne. Her latest album, Bring It On Home, was nominated for Best Blues Album at the 2013 Grammy Awards. It's a fine album indeed. And you'll find links at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Joan's latest project, a new album titled Love and Hate, is scheduled for release early next year. You'll also find links on our website to Arts Greensboro, ticket information, and the complete 17 days festival performance schedule. Joan kicks off the 2.5 weeks of music, art, theater, and more with an 8 o'clock concert Friday night, September 20th, in Dana Auditorium. This year's 17 Days Festival runs through October 6th with more than 130 arts events planned. We'll hear from two more of this year's headliners after this short break, the amazing singer-songwriter Aoife O'Donovan and multiple Grammy-winning cellist Matt Heimovitz next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
I need rest. What I need is his tenderness.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Friday, September 20th is the first day of what will be an intensive 2.5 weeks of captivating art, music, theater, and more in the Triad. It's Arts Greensboro's 17 Days Festival, running through October 6th with more than 130 arts events planned, some familiar and some that may be new to you. Like my second guest today, Aoife O'Donovan. That's A-O-I-F-E, if you didn't already know. And if you did, chances are you're already a big fan of the 30-year-old Boston native singer-songwriter and her amazing music.
With a hammer and nails and a fear of fame, we are building a shell.
Aoife can tear up a Joni Mitchell classic like Amelia, write and record gut-wrenchingly beautiful tunes of her own, and she's also the lead singer for the progressive bluegrass string band Crooked Still. Aoife is a member of the female folk noir trio Sometimes Why, and she's already performed with a who's who list of legendary musicians, including Jerry Douglas, Chris Thiele, Dave Douglas, and Yo-Yo Ma. This summer, Aoife toured with Garrison Keillor and his A Prairie Home Companion Radio Romance Tour, and this week, she comes to Greensboro as part of 17 Days. Aoife and her band will perform at the intimate Triad stage downtown on Monday night, September 23rd at 8 o'clock. She spoke with me by phone from her home in Boston. I'm going to start, if you don't mind, I want to talk a little bit about, you were, our listeners probably or may or may not know that you were part of the Grammy Award-winning album, the Goat Rodeo Sessions. Several musicians on the top of the world on their respective instruments in that group, including cellist Yo-Yo Ma, bassist Edgar Meyer, and fiddler Stuart Duncan. And wondering what you got out of that experience and what they got out of performing with Aoife O'Donovan.
Well, of course, I mean, I think there's much for me to gain from that experience. Getting to sort of walk into a quartet. They had sort of existed as a quartet in the rehearsal phase for longer than my involvement. Their kind of existence as the four of them getting together and writing music for this as of then unnamed project was very cool. And I think Chris and Edgar and the label Sony was really interested in having a female vocalist involved. And I think that as opposed to sort of hiring in kind of a big gun, sort of really famous singer, they kind of wanted to go the opposite direction and kind of bring in a pretty much an unknown and kind of let that kind of be. I don't know what their thinking was exactly, but Chris and I have a history of singing together and have some pretty great musical chemistry, and I think that they wanted to sort of explore where that would go within that ensemble.
Where did it go in terms of? I am actually curious to know what kind of feedback you got from those folks. I got a chance to hear Edgar Meyer with Zakir Hussain and Bella Fleck a couple of years ago, and I know that the level of performance for all of you is so extraordinary. Did they talk to you at all about what they're getting out of that kind of give and take with you, the vocalist, in that ensemble?
It was a pretty rewarding experience. I'm definitely confident in saying that, but everybody had a really great time, and we just finished a tour. We just finished our first tour. Cross-country, we had played our last show at the Hollywood Bowl a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, I guess, and it was just a real thrill.
Great. And you're going to be performing here in town as part of the Greensboro's 17 Days Festival at Triad Stage, which is a neat little, an intimate venue, as they say, September 23rd.
Great.
Yeah, it's a neat little venue. I'm wondering if this, is this going to be the trio act with Jacob Silver on bass and Austin Evans on guitar, or is it going to be you solo?
Exactly. No, it's that exact trio. We're heading out on the road on Thursday. Jake and Austin both played, and Jake is a long-time collaborator of mine. We've been playing music together for 12 years in various ensembles. And Austin is an old pal from the Boston area, and he's usually on tour with Josh Ritter, the great songwriter Josh Ritter, but Josh has some downtime this fall, and Austin's played with me in June, and I'm really excited to get him back on the road for this September run.
Nice. What's that setting like for you, Aoife, in terms of playing within a trio like that? What are you hearing that might be different from a different group, and what do you love about that kind of give and take?
Well, you know what? This is going to be our first tour as a trio with guitar, bass, and me. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's really exciting to get to do something new. We've done a lot of full band stuff and a lot of solo stuff and a lot of duo stuff. I've done a couple duo tours with Jake on bass.
But to get to sort of play my music with bass and guitar is something that I haven't yet done yet. So this is going to kind of be the beta test for the tour, but I'm pretty confident that, because of such great musicians, and so I'll be playing acoustic, Jake will be playing upright bass, and Austin will be playing electric guitar. I think it's going to be a pretty great blend of sound.
In the middle of everything I started to see, you said you were a beekeeper, but I heard no bees. I asked you, where do you get your honey? You said, darling, I'm a beekeeper, I'm up to my knees. Oh, I'm a lonely sailor on a sinking boat.
Do you listen to a lot of jazz?
I do. I've studied in college with a great jazz singer. I went to New England Conservatory and studied jazz and contemporary improvisation. And my teacher was the great Dominique Eade, an incredible, incredible jazz vocalist. And, you know, that's not really what I'm listening to most these days. But, of course, some of the classic jazz recordings I kind of have rediscovered on vinyl recently. Some Billie Holiday records and some Fitzgerald and Chris Connor and Carmen McRae and sort of singers like that. Chet Baker is a huge influence on me. His singing style, kind of the jazz singer who sings almost like a folk singer, I think.
Well, you also share in common just amazing pitch. You guys, I mean, you just don't miss. I'm wondering, I was struck by your rhythmic approach. I mean, it's just so so cool. It just made me think about that a little bit. You just real comfy and great rhythmic grooves.
Yeah, I think when you study for me, I grew up around music and always played music, but then kind of to get inside of it in the conservatory environment, and also to be, you know, all the people that I've gotten to play with in my life and my career thus far have been, some of the most just crazy, badass musicians ever. So you really kind of learn on the road like that, you know, that's how you hone your skills.
Yeah.
Red and white and blue and gold. Water to touch my toes on the beach. It's the 4th of July. I wanna wait for the fire to burn in my eyes. Come on, sit next to me. Bury my feet in the sand. There's a hole that's 12 miles deep. I dug it with my hands. Come on, lie next to me.
I've always had a soft spot for expressions and their origins and cliches and stuff, and you make great use of a few of those in this tune, like Leave This Jukebox Joint Behind and I Want to Buy the Farm, and to show
I'm so glad that you caught those.
Well, I love them. I mean, it's really I'm kind of a cliche junkie. So, but you use them in this great way to show your devotion or your willingness to be devoted to this other person. I mean, on the one hand, it seems like you're breaking the songwriter rules. You know, cliches are bad. But why does it work so well in this context? It's a great tune.
I think the By the Farm cliche is actually pretty interesting, because I think a lot of people hear that lyric and they think that I mean something different. They think that I mean literally go buy a farm with you, because it's sort of in that verse of the song is. I mean, that's a pretty, that song is a sad song. It's sort of it's a song of great longing and a song of sort of almost of despair, but sort of kind of resignment, I think is a good word for it. So, you know, it's, I want to float down a river with you. I want to buy the farm. It's like, I want to die with you almost. But that cliche, that line, I think I learned that expression from the banjo player in Crooked Still reading the Ralph Stanley book out loud. So that's kind of an old timey expression, like, oh, he bought the farm. And I was like, what does that even mean? And Greg's like, oh, I mean, died. And I just think it's some of those archaic cliches kind of need to be brought back.
Yeah.
And you can kind of trick somebody with it because they're not even 100% sure that they're listening to a cliche. So I think that kind of makes it okay.
Hear, hear.
I want to follow you home. I want to see your place. Want to take you in my arms. Float down a river with you. I wanna buy the farm. Come on, let's run away. Baby, let's go. Let's go. There's a southbound train.
You do this throughout so many of your songs that I'm hearing these quick, concise phrases like Fumble for the Buttons on My Dress, which paints such a a vivid image or feeling so quickly? How do you know when you've arrived at the right lyric, Aoife, and where it just hits you like this is what I'm after?
I'm always going for something that makes I want myself. I mean, I think I want to feel moved by other people's music. You know, when I listen to a song, I'm always kind of waiting for that lyric that just gets stuck in my head, and I'm like, oh God, that gets me. And so I think I'm trying to do that, of course, in my own songs, and it's hard. It's hard to sort of to know when you reach that point. That song that you just brought up, Thursday's Child, that song had 50 verses before I came to the verses that made it into the song. I mean, I'm not even exaggerating. It had so many verses. It was about something totally different. But that chorus, the, oh, my tyranny seemed to crumble, come sit next to me and fumble with the buttons on my dress, that was this image that kind of was constant through it. And the fact that I kept on writing all these other verses and yet would still keep on coming back to that chorus, like those lyrics of the chorus, just made me feel like maybe it was stronger than I thought.
I got nothing to hide. I'm as naked as the day I was born. In November, and you know what they say. Thursday's child is far to go. Should I leave you behind and drive to Alaska on Saturday night? These four walls around me are keeping up light.
I got nothing to hide. I'm as naked as the day I was born in November. That kind of vulnerability, I'm wondering, you know, in the moment you've created it and then you're performing that for different audiences over time, does your feeling for a song change, say, when you wrap up this Fossils tour coming up, or is it pretty much the same?
So Thursday's Child is actually a pretty good example, because that song, when I'm singing it on the record, it's a little bit, the hide is elongated, but it's not that long. When I sing that song live, I kind of use that line to really try to pull the audience in to what I'm saying, and often I'll hold out, I've got nothing to hide, for, I mean, literally as long as I possibly can, and there's something swelling underneath me, or maybe it's just my voice in the room, and if there's people talking at the bar, they usually stop talking as I'm holding out that note. Got nothing to hide. It's sort of, that's almost the most vulnerable part of the whole show.
Wow.
And I think that every time I kind of get to the end of that note, I'm back into the song. Sort of like that opening line can take me out of wherever I'm at. If, you know, if it's a good show, if it's a bad show, whatever it is, whatever mood I'm in, that can kind of get me back into that song. And that song is very specific to me about sort of a feeling that I had about wanting to take a road trip alone, wanting to be in a car totally alone, driving across the Alcan, the Alaska-Canada Highway, and but maybe leaving somebody behind and not really being sure what, just kind of general life conflict. But at the core of it is this idea of taking a solo road trip. Sometimes you're loneliest when you're not alone. But sometimes when you're alone, you actually feel it's a much more rewarding, fulfilling feeling. And I think that a lot of these songs, I don't know how it is for every songwriter, but it is important to me to really try to be feeling whatever it is that I'm singing into, so I can give the audience, or whoever, even if it's an audience of two or an audience of 200, to make people feel something. I mean, I want to feel something. I want to feel something as a performer. I want to feel something as an audience member. I love seeing live music, so I feel like I really respect the audience. I think a lot of musicians have such busy schedules that they don't often get to concerts. And I'm so excited today. I'm going to go see Laura Marling play tonight at Music Hall of Williamsburg. And I can't wait for that. I can't wait to be in the audience and be captivated by somebody else's performance. I think it's just one of the most special experiences that you can have. And to get to be a performer and to be on both sides of that just feels so fortunate to me.
I got nothing to hide. I'm laying it out there. Take it or leave it, you can't figure it out. Thursday's child is far to go. Buttons on my dress.
USA Today calls her the new darling of the Americana set, and I call her one great musician, Aoife O'Donovan. She'll be performing Monday night, September 23rd at 8 o'clock on the set of Triad Stage's current production, the Broadway thriller Wait Until Dark, set in a Greenwich Village apartment. It's all part of the 17 Days Festival in Greensboro, with more than 130 arts, music, and theater events being showcased at venues all across the city through October 6th. You'll find links to the complete 17 Days calendar at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You'll also find links there for ticket information and Aoife's album Fossils. Rolling Stone calls it a must-listen, and you can hear selections live right here in the Triad on Monday night. What a great way to kick away those Monday blues. But right now, it's the weekend, Triad Arts Weekend to be exact. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short little intermission, we've got more great music coming your way. For years, multiple Grammy-winning cellist Matt Heimovitz has been inspiring classical music lovers and welcoming skeptics into the fold all across the country in venues that might just surprise you, and eclectic programs that will stretch your perception of what a cello recital can be next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and cellist and multiple Grammy winner Matt Heimovitz has inspired classical music lovers and countless new listeners by bringing fresh music to concert halls and clubs, outdoor festivals, intimate coffee houses, just about anywhere he can reach listeners with passionate performances of world-class music. Coming up Friday night, September 27th at 8 o'clock, Matt brings that passion to the University of North Carolina at Greensboro Recital Hall as part of the 17 Days Festival. In Beyond Bach, Matt will explore everything from classic Jimi Hendrix tunes to an unaccompanied Bach cello suite. He spoke with me recently by cell phone in between performances in Montreal. Well, it seems like you've really, over the last several years, arrived in a fantastic place in terms of your performance career. What do you say to the venerable, you know, old teacher or naysayer who says to you, you know, Matthew, you could have had a real cello soloist career performing the great cello rep with orchestras all over the world all the time. Why this? Why Hendrix in a coffee house? How do you break it down for that perspective, someone from leaning that way?
For the most part, an artist of any generation, no matter how venerable, they understand the responsibility of keeping the tradition alive and passing it on. My own teacher, Leonard Rose, I often imagine, what would he say, you know, hearing my Jimi Hendrix arrangement? However, I think in the end he would understand, because I think he would understand that I'm going out and building new audience. You know, he would know that my generation has different challenges than his generation, and that the ultimate goal is to keep the tradition going and to keep it healthy and breathing and alive, and to communicate on any given day to however many people to share this music. Mm. And so I think most artists understand that, no matter what generation they come from. Mm-hmm. And I know for me, I'm teaching now at McGill University, and I have a studio of cellists, and I take them on the road occasionally, and we play as a cello ensemble, Ucello. And in fact, we have a new project coming out right now for kids called Angel Heart, a music storybook, and we're going to be doing the world premiere of that at Carnegie Hall and in San Francisco at Cal Performances. So I take them to clubs too, but they have the experience of doing this, you know, in the theater, and the idea that anything is possible, that they should broaden their outlook, and that music doesn't stand on its own, that it can interact and relate to other fields, literature, and, well, there's going to be an app for this thing, so it's going to, the technological aspect and interactive aspect, and just that, you know, we can open our minds and think about what we do differently, and that's another way to grow the audience and connect with audiences. We'll be right back.
Could you give me an example of a piece or venue, maybe in the last 5 years or so, that worked, you know, even better than you had hoped in terms of audience engagement, and then maybe one that fell flat? Maybe you thought, oh, this is going to be fantastic, and it just didn't quite go over.
Well, it always surprises me when I play Elliot Carter in the context of, you know, I'll always play Bach, and of course that just never fails. I mean, if I play a Bach cello suite, that always universally connects with an audience. But sometimes, I'll include an Elliot Carter figment, 5 minutes long, and, you know, I'll think that people might walk out. They don't. But I always prepare it, you know, with, like, if you hate this, in 5 minutes, it's over. And so it's kind of like reverse psychology.
Should point out for listeners, I should point out for non-classical musicians that Elliot Carter, the late, great Elliot Carter, a 20th century composer who lived well into his 90s, I want to say, very influential in terms of his
technique. Actually, he was 103, I believe, when he passed away.
But he really was an intellectual composer par excellence. But his music maybe not the most accessible I won't put a cap on it. You get what I mean. But maybe not the most accessible.
He's an uncompromising composer, very influenced by jazz and other elements. But like you said, very complex, many layered. You know, a lot of stuff happening all at once. Counterpoint, but. On first hearing, you might say, oh, that's the kind of music that is responsible for turning audiences off to contemporary music, contemporary classical music. But in context, after hearing Bach and then hearing the Elliot Carter, it just it always amazes me that people really can connect with it, because it's so visceral, it's so kinetic, and somehow the drama of the contrast with the Bach is so extreme, and just seeing what the range of the instrument can do, and things are flying by really fast, and so even though people might not comprehend at first listen what, you know, everything that the piece has to offer, they do latch on to something very very energetic and immediate, and so that always surprises me. You know, my one failure. Well, I'm sure I've had more than one failure, but one,
that's
one
a great
that comes
record.
To mind is on a rock and roll tour years ago with the Rokidoki Music Seminar, and we were traveling 10 cities in 10 days, and the first city, I believe it was Iowa City or Des Moines, somewhere in Iowa anyway, and I was the only classical musician, and I was opening the show, and I thought, oh man, I have to be really cutting edge and hit, and so I started with all my contemporary stuff. I believe I started with the David Sanford 7th Avenue Kaddish piece and Goli Hope piece and some other things, and the promoter came back to me after that first show, and he said, you know, all the contemporary stuff is really great, but do you mind giving us a little love at the start of the program? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, could you play a little Bach? I was like, really? On a rock and roll show, you're asking me to play Bach? So I learned my lesson. You know, I think that basically you can take it in any direction you want, but giving people a little love first is always a good idea.
Giving a little love. That's great. I'm wondering, Matt, traveling the country as you do by car, occasionally playing these concerts and performing Bach solo works for cello to a whole host of different venues. What kind of insight has that given you about this country, about the people who live here? I mean, that's you've got to have, in some ways, your finger on the pulse of what's going on out there.
Well, I was doing that more, you know, a couple of years ago. I mean, now it's more in the plane. In fact, I took two cellos on the plane the other day to Chicago and Texas, and I had to get places a little quicker. But I love driving, and I love driving through the United States. It's so diverse. There's so much beauty of landscape and different landscapes, different cultures. You know, it's amazing how filtered the view is of what we get, you know, in terms of red and blue states. It's just, it does not exist when you are traveling by car and stopping at a truck stop and having conversations with truckers and then, you know, having other kinds of conversations at venues with people. And one thing that I realize is every community, no matter how, you know, remote it is from a major urban center or whatnot, there's always people who are interested in expanding their intellectual view or their just sense of curiosity or expanding their musical input and taking a chance on discovering new music or adventurous music.
A sense of some of the different places you've played throughout your life, Matt. Could you give us the variety of the venues that you've chosen throughout the years?
One of my favorites, Seattle Tractor Tavern. It's a honky-tonk bar in Seattle. Churchill's in Miami is middle of a Haitian slum. And I guess they've made some MTV videos over there for some hip-hop groups. And it's a great, great venue. Wow. CBGB, of course, in New York, which is now defunct, but you know, the birthplace of punk, the whole punk movement.
What drew you to Jimi Hendrix?
Definitely the electric guitar with his music. I mean, when I heard the Star Spangled Banner, I was in my first year of college when I heard it first time, and it just blew me away. And then, you know, getting to know some of the tunes, I mean, a Machine Gun, great war protest song, and just the sheer, this raw energy to it. The guitar playing is really, as an instrumentalist, I'm really into it in terms of the virtuosity, the power of it, just the sound that he was creating, and distortion, all that.
The distort, hearing your performance, which is really incredible, and you get a chance to see it on YouTube, like, at least excerpts. We'll post the link there. Are you? I can't even see in the picture. Are you utilizing pedals, or is this all harmonics and stuff you're working with the instrument? So.
No, it's totally acoustic.
Wow.
I wasn't using any pedals, and I rarely use pedals. I'm more interested in trying to get the effects acoustically and how it translates. How do I play wrong to get those interesting sounds out of the instrument?
It's amazing.
So, yeah, it's definitely acoustic. And in fact, when I come down to Greensboro, I'm going to play a new arrangement of Helter Skelter, a Beatles tune. I haven't really played much Beatles, so this is, of course, the noisiest Beatles tunes I could find, and it's arranged by Luna Pearl Wolf, composer, and also my wife.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Is it tough shifting from Hendrix to Bach? And you know, what are those transitions like in performance for you?
You know, no, because, I mean, I basically subscribe to the Duke Ellington philosophy of music. There's two kinds of music. There's the good kind and the other kind. And so for me, it's part of one trajectory. I program carefully, but it's the same wiring involved.
Thank you. cellist and multiple Grammy winner Matt Heimovitz. You can hear Matt perform live as part of the 17 Days Festival Friday night, September 27th at 8 o'clock in the intimate confines of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro Recital Hall. You'll find links to ticket information and the complete 17 Days schedule at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Matt's latest multimedia project is the educational CD and book for children titled Angel Heart, narrated by Jeremy Irons. Angel Heart will be out as an app in just a few months, and live productions of the show in New York, San Francisco, and elsewhere around the country will include video elements as well. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find podcasts of Triad Arts Weekend, along with pictures and lots of helpful links, on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.